Welcome to Dialogue, a true crime conversation. I am your host, Rebecca Sebastian. I am so happy you've joined me. We are in week two of our four-week series on justice, injustice, and today's guest just couldn't be more fitting. I think she follows up last week's episode so well and really sets up my next episode perfectly, so I'm thrilled to have today's guest. Now, who am I talking about? You might know her from her work on the Oxygen docuseries, The Disappearance of Maura Murray. But long before that, my guest had a substantial career in reporting and journalism and producing. Of course, I'm talking about Maggie Freeling. And, you know, she wasn't always the true crime personality that we know and love now, and she certainly didn't set out to be that. I'm going to let her tell you all about it. But the main reason Maggie and I met to talk, virtually of course, is because she just came out with a new podcast called Unjust and Unsolved, and Maggie is focusing entirely on wrongful convictions. I think we're seeing a theme here, right? Because of last week's episode with David Rudolph and Sonia Pfeiffer. I love that this is trending in true crime and that the genre is expanding to include these cases. And the podcast is amazing. It just came out last week with the first two episodes out, so you can go subscribe to Unjust and Unsolved and listen now. I'm actually going to play a trailer here, and then we're going to get right into our conversation. And as always, if you could subscribe to Dialogue so you don't miss an episode, rate and review if you're enjoying the show. I so appreciate that. And without further ado, here is a trailer for Unjust and Unsolved with Maggie Freeling.
My name is Maggie Freeling. I'm an investigative journalist, and I'm excited to tell you about my new podcast from the Obsessed Network called Unjust and Unsolved. Each episode tells the story of a person who, I believe, has been wrongfully incarcerated. The Innocence Project gives a conservative estimate that there are over 20,000 innocent people locked away in U.S. prisons. When I learned this, I sent letters to those whose stories haunted me. I heard back from almost everyone. They all wanted to be heard. And so on Unjust and Unsolved, I'm doing just that. I speak with those people, their loved ones, advocates, and lawyers, diving deep into the crimes they were convicted of and presenting the evidence that points away from them. And if it wasn't them, then who was it? Help me search for an answer. You can find Unjust and Unsolved and all Obsessed Network podcasts on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you're listening right now.
Maggie, thank you so much for being on Dialogue, a true crime conversation.
Thank you so much for having me. This is exciting.
Yeah, it is. It's exciting to talk to another New Yorker. I always enjoy that. And have you been here the whole 2020 during COVID? Yeah.
I have. This is actually the longest I haven't traveled ever. So I'm very like stir crazy right now. Like usually I travel like once a month at least. So I'm really going nuts.
Yeah. And how's your experience been just staying put, not just with work being kind of on hold, but just the state of New York? How have you been?
You know, New York's New York. Things are still going on. Yeah. Still have, you know, I feel like things are fairly normal. We got really lucky. We had moved actually out of a really tiny apartment into a much bigger one right before this. So if we had been stuck in that other one, I truly think we would have gone insane.
Good. I'm really glad to hear that. Yeah. We have a very unique situation too. The rooms are not big, but everybody has their own because all of a sudden my kids are doing class from home. I'm doing this and my job moved home. So did my husband. So I was like, I don't know how we manage this, but we all have a door and walls to do our own thing. So thankfully, we're all
super
alive.
Important. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, cool. I know a lot of people associate you with true crime in the genre, but it seems to me like your journalism background and work centered around a lot of topics more broadly. So I'd love to hear about that and where you think that intersection to true crime is. Let's start there. I'd like to hear about your work as a journalist.
Yeah. So I never imagined myself being here as a true crime personality. You know, I went to school for journalism. I kind of always thought I would be, you know, an international reporter or, you know, someone working on human rights issues, which of course true crime does involve. But, you know, more so I started working with women's issues and I did a lot of reporting on genocides and, you know, it kind of just evolved from there. So I really had that passion. Anything I wanted to do in journalism was going to have a human rights component to it. Mm-hmm. There was a small portion of my life where I did work at the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service because I also love animals and wildlife conservation.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah, and I still, you know, I still love that. That's just like my spare time fun stuff that I do. But yeah, so, you know, eventually I started working more in immigration issues and immigrants' stories crossing the border, you know, especially lately. Early 2015, post 2016 Trump election, I started visiting detention centers and telling women's stories inside detention centers. And that's really kind of where I envisioned my life going.
Yeah.
And then I got a phone call to do the Maura Murray documentary out of literally nowhere. I was working at WNYC doing like city reporting, local government reporting, and I didn't want to do it. I was like, this is weird. I never wanted to do TV. I never wanted to do, because for me, it was always about other people. It was never like, I'm not going to be this like Nancy Grace figure. It's like, you know what I mean? Like yeah. About me. It was always about other people. I always wanted to elevate other people's stories. And so I really had an issue with doing it. I didn't want to do it. We all know I did it. And it's just kind of become my life from there.
That's really interesting. I didn't know that. And can I ask, why do you think your name was in the hat? Why did they reach out to you other than maybe they were following your reporting and were like, hey, she's an investigator. She's good. She's talented. Is that how you got the call?
So I do know. Yeah, it is. So they were specifically looking for a woman who was a journalist.
Okay.
And had ties to either Maura and or UMass. And I did, I went to UMass. And I had a mentor from NPR back in the day. We're still good friends now, but he told me to always make sure my LinkedIn was up to date. He was like, this is how people are going to find you. It's the new, you know, it's the new thing. Mm-hmm. So literally they Googled female journalist UMass. And I came up on LinkedIn. Like, that is how I was found.
Wow. That is a great little tidbit for, like, people younger in their earlier in their career. Yeah. Like, it probably still holds true. I know it feels dated and kind of passe, but I do still look at people on LinkedIn because also mm-hmm. you always want to know, do I know somebody at Spotify mm-hmm. or wherever? And then do I know anybody who knows anybody there? So it is helpful. And it's not Facebook, which is always nice. Yeah. Okay, so they call you, and so you didn't, how familiar were you with Maura's story?
So this was going to be my addendum. So I have been obsessed with true crime since I was probably 10 years old.
Oh, good. Tell us everything.
Yeah, so, you know, ID was like the only true crime channel, really. And I remember like sneaking home and watching ID, watching Disappeared, like watching all these shows, like it was like a secret. Like I was watching like porn in my room or something. Like uh-huh. I didn't want my parents to know I was watching this because it felt so like salacious. And there was something just like wrong with watching it, I felt as a kid. But I did know Maura's story because it aired on Disappeared, I forget the year, but it was sometime around 2010, 2012, somewhere in that area I had seen it. So I was familiar with it. And the craziest thing is, and I'm so serious, and no one's ever going to believe this, but this is my truth. I had Googled her just days before I got the phone call because I was like, whatever happened to that girl that went missing from UMass?
That's so weird.
So when they started calling, I thought it was like something in my search engine maybe that like somewhat like, I thought it was like a hoax. Like I thought yeah. someone was like lurking my IP and browser and calling me because I was like, I seriously just Googled this girl and now I'm getting phone calls about her.
That is so interesting. Uncanny. Meant to be, I guess.
Yeah.
I guess.
I think it was.
Yeah. Some of those things just, you look back, you're like, oh, that was all happening unbeknownst to me. So you say yes, and you didn't know Tim and Lance, I assume, of the Crawl Space Network, for anybody who doesn't know, at the time. So this was your introduction where they, I assume they were like in place already on the project.
Yes. Well, they had already, producers had already reached out to them as well to work on the project. Yeah. So they told me like, you're going to be working with these to losers. Just kidding, not at all. Like, we were doing these two amazing people. Yeah, and like the video footage of me meeting them, I like cringe watching it because it's, I'm like so cheesy because I just like loved them from the second I met them. They're just so genuine and so nice.
Very easy to love, yes.
Yeah, and they totally caught me off guard with how fun and goofy and genuine they are.
Yeah, they really are that. So you go in and I'll make sure to link. A lot of people have and are familiar with, I see like the beginning of an animal and I love it.
I know, she's going crazy. I'm like, is she bothering? Can you hear her running around?
I can't hear anything. Okay. No, I just saw a tail. I've got one running around somewhere too, a dog. So most people probably would have seen the oxygen special, the disappearance of Mara Murray. So this really does end up being the catalyst for your true crime career, intended or not. So what happens after?
I was asked to do other shows, you know, I mean, from there, the show was very popular. It was at the time, you know, it really was launching. That's what I knew when they did it. It was launching Oxygen's rebranding. They were rebranding from kind of the Bad Girls Club into True Crime. So this was one of the first shows and it was super popular. So people were like, constantly reaching out to me. And, you know, this wasn't something I was doing because I had to do it. I wanted to. So I was super picky. Clearly I've said no to everything that came my way. I wanted to do something that felt right. I had pitched a lot of ideas, stories that I wanted to work on. They didn't pan out. You know, the stories that I want to tell were stories that people didn't know as much. For example, missing women of color. A lot of those stories are not prominent because we all know about, you know, white girl syndrome, the whole situation. And so that would literally happen. I would pitch some of these stories and I was told, well, people don't really know about this, so it's not going to be a Natalie Holloway name grabbing.
Yeah.
Like, well, that's the point. I want people to know about these stories, you know? So it was like, I was stuck in these catch-22s when I was pitching. And that's when I kind of was just like, I'm not really interested. I had worked in development for another show for a bit and that kind of just didn't happen. So, you know, I continued doing my work at the show at NPR that I love, working with immigrants. I did an entire investigative piece about sexual abuse in detention centers.
Wow.
You know, doing what I wanted to do, telling the story of marginalized people. And you know, that's what I'm doing now. I mean, who's more marginalized than people in prison?
Yeah, let's talk about your new show. And as we start talking about your new podcast, which I'm super excited about, I think it's really interesting because from where I sit, I think the genre is changing. I think it's finally moving in a direction where I think we're expanding the definition of true crime, which I think for a while it was very limited to these big, salacious stories that centered around a person mainstream America could prioritize and care about, frankly. And I think that's changing. And so I want to hear what your thoughts on that are. And then so you're getting to do a show about cases that you really care about. And I want to hear in your words about your upcoming podcast, Unjust and Unsolved.
Yeah. So, you know, again, so I'm going back to pitching and I'm just like, I want, you know, for anyone who knows me, like and just a bull. When I want something, I'm going to do that. I'm not going to stray from it. And I do feel like the Oxygen series did stray a little bit from who I am, you know, the core of myself as a journalist. It wasn't necessarily journalism. It was entertainment advocacy, I think, is the category I would give it.
Yeah, that's fair.
And I didn't have any, you know, editorial, any kind of that kind of control. There were certain times I did put my foot down and say, no, I will absolutely not do that. But I didn't want to have a role like that anymore. I didn't want to not have control of what was happening. And, you know, there were things that I wanted to put in that were so important. I wanted to talk about Namus. I wanted to talk about how Mora could be, you know, a Jane Doe in Alabama and we would never know just because of the way our system works. And I wasn't allowed to do that. We had to have psychics instead. So from there, I kind of just said, you know, I'm not doing that anymore. I'm only doing what I want to do. So fortunately, Patrick and I became friends at CrimeCon 2019. It was CrimeCon.
Oh, that's so soon. Just last year. That was New Orleans.
New Orleans. Yes.
Okay. That was,
no, we became friends. I'm blanking on my CrimeCons. No, we became friends the year before, 2018.
Okay.
In Nashville.
Nashville. I wasn't there. My first one was New Orleans, but go on.
Okay. Patrick is going to be like, you're so wrong. We became friends one of these crime cons.
Yeah.
And he almost choked on his eggs because I surprised him at breakfast and we had never met in person. And he literally gasped and screeched and squealed.
What? I can't imagine.
No, exactly. And it was literally like a love affair since then. I mean, as much of a love affair as you could have with a gay man and a very straight woman. And, you know, we had always talked. He was like, I want to put you on, if I have a network, I want to do something with you. You know, what do you want to do? Can we do something together? So it was, you know, us talking back and forth for a while about this. And sometime this fall, you know, we had pitched things because, you know, I was starting to get a lot of people reaching out to me to cover disappearance cases. And I just felt disappearances were so, not that anything gets oversaturated, because there can never be enough advocacy, but it's a place where there are a lot of advocates. So he kept saying, what do you want to do? And I knew it wasn't going to be disappearances. I actually have another podcast coming out this fall. I can't say the network yet. It's a 6-part documentary series about a man who spent his life in prison, was supposed to die in prison. And so once I started working with people who were formerly incarcerated, he would tell me about all these people he knew who were wrongfully incarcerated. Mm-hmm. And I started thinking, and then I just started Googling, like, wrongful incarceration podcasts. Like, do people do anything on this? Of course, Jason Flom, who's one of the board directors of the Innocence Project, has his.
Yep.
Aside from that, there wasn't any kind of weekly, each week a different, shedding light on a different story. You know, of course, we have Bob Ruff with Truth and Justice. That's an entire investigative series.
Right.
There was no one doing case each week. And I was just like, I have to do this. I have to do this. I mean, this is exactly what I want to do. I want to tell people stories. I want to give people voices through the platform that I am so grateful to have. Mm-hmm. And Patrick, I think he was nervous at first, because I think he really wanted something more sexy. Like, he wanted something like True Crime Obsessed, like something that immediately is like fun. Like, you definitely don't think of wrongful incarcerations. Nothing is fun about that.
Right.
And we went through a few versions. Patrick was in one of them. And then it kind of developed into what it is.
And so tell us what it is. And I have so much I want to respond to, but tell us what Unjust and Unsolved is, what we can expect when it drops. I think when you guys are all hearing this, it will be out. So make sure you're subscribed and getting the new episodes, but tell us what we're going to hear.
Yeah. So it started with me going, okay, can I even do this? Is this even possible? Is it possible to talk to people who are currently incarcerated? And I wrote 20 incarcerated people letters. I found them. You can find anybody. You can just write to them. I wrote them letters. It was wild. Almost all of them responded, being like, yes, please tell my story. Oh my gosh. Some of them are bigger cases that people know of. Some of them were people that were like, no one has ever wanted to listen to me. Like, and I just cried. Patrick and I literally just cried, and we were like, wow, that was when it was like, this is what we have to do.
Right.
So each week it's me speaking with a person who I believe is wrongfully convicted, about, you know, their life, what happened to them, where, you know, I want to give them their whatever back that I can. And in this sense, it is their voices. Mm-hmm. And, you know, giving them some sort of control of their lives and their story. So I give them that freedom of, what do you want to talk about? You know, I usually do prompt, you know, what was your family like? Who are you as a person.
Yeah.
That's not, you know, inmate number, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
Blah, blah.
Outside those walls. Yeah.
And so it's them telling their stories about themselves. I mean, some of them, I mean, all of them are dynamic humans, but you know, some of them are really just these amazing people who had lives and had families, and it was just all stolen from them. And so, you know, you get to hear that. I speak with loved ones and advocates. A lot of them have advocates that have been with them for 7, 10, 20 years.
Wow.
Don't get paid, just believe in their cause. Some of them turn into spouses. So that's what you'll hear each episode. And you know, it was so hard because we wanted to put, you know, quote, the best first. And every episode Patrick heard, he was like, this story is even more compelling and wow, upsetting and jarring than the last one. And it's just like, it's mind blowing every time, just what can happen to people.
Thank you for listening to another great podcast on the Crawl Space Media Network. I'm Jared Ortiz.
I'm Nick Porchetta.
I'm Samantha Vasquez.
And our show is Even the Podcast is Afraid.
We release episodes every Monday, bringing you the real life and fictional horrors of true crime, the paranormal, and the unexplained.
We combine in-depth research from our host Jared and our elbow-deep researcher and writer Stephanie Kemmerer,
while bringing you a comedic approach to serial killers, cults, demons, and all sorts of weird and macabre history.
But if you're interested in everything morbid and grisly, then listen to Even the Podcast is Afraid for free on your favorite podcast listening app, and visit our website at eventhepodcastisafraid.com for even more information on the show.
While you're there, check out some of our fan favorite episodes, like The Disappearance of Michael Rockefeller, the sadistic serial killer couple Fred and Rose West, the true story of the Amityville Horror, and more.
Be sure to subscribe to the show or be cursed.
And now we will let you get back to the awesome podcast you were listening to from the Crawlspace Media Network.
I am so excited to hear these. So are most of your guests pursuing appeals? Are they in the process? And how do you measure the threshold of innocence? Or are you looking for actual innocence or cases where there were problems in their representation and they perhaps deserve another trial? Or what are you thinking and who are you working with to determine the best fit in terms of a candidate to be on the show?
Yeah, that's a really great question. So personally, I'm looking at actual innocence, but we did leave it open because I have come across some compelling stories of people who have gotten felony murder convictions, which are, you know, in certain states, if you happen to just be standing next to somebody who kills someone,
Texas.
You're exactly
crazy.
And New York did. I don't want to say if New York still does, but I know New York did have that. So, you know, we left it open for the unjust. So any, you know, these unjust convictions. But for myself, for most of them, I am looking at actual innocence, and it's a really hard bar. So for at least season one, I'm doing cases that have been vetted by the Innocence Project.
Okay.
Are being worked on with the Innocence Project because they have a very high bar.
Yeah, they do.
But unfortunately, they do only do DNA cases. So that also leaves out a lot of cases that I'm working with that are not Innocence Project vetted, but have pretty much, you know, had former prosecutors say, yeah, this person's innocent and I should not have prosecuted. You know, like, I'm definitely going on those bars where people involved, judges, prosecutors, witness recantments, you know, it's pretty clear that this person did not do it.
Mm-hmm.
And I am thinking for either Patreons, I haven't told this to Patrick yet, so surprise, Patrick, but Patreons or bonus content, you know, I have a lot of people writing to me who haven't been vetted in that sense and aren't, you know, high profile enough or lucky enough to have a former prosecutor or judge say, you know, this person is wrongfully convicted.
Right.
To maybe have listeners listen to their story and just tell the story with the facts that this person has told me. Here are the documents they've given me. I'll put them online for y'all. And if you feel compelled to investigate yourselves, like, please do.
Interesting.
Because I think, you know, it's the same thing with this catch 22 with the white girl syndrome and not telling stories of people of color in true crime. It's like, how are these people who are wrongfully convicted and aren't the West Memphis Three, you know, how are they going to get their stories out there? Someone has to listen. So I do want to do something with those. And they aren't wrongfully convicted. Maybe they're just duping us all, but I think their stories are worth listening to. And I think, you know, the listeners can help evaluate that.
Yeah. I mean, I think a lot about this because I've been following the Innocence Project for many years. I'm a big fan, big supporter of their work. It's so weird. But prior to this podcast, I still have a true crime trivia show, but it came before Dialogue. So it's called Yellow Tape. And I do this live show in New York City. Actually, when we can someday be in person, you should come to one of my shows.
I would love to.
And all the proceeds always went to the Innocence Project because that was just my like redemptive piece of having fun around these topics. And again, it's sort of in the same vein as True Crime Obsessed. There's no wrongdoing. There's no victim blaming happening or even glorification of really horrific things. We were playing it straight, but the donation piece just made me feel like we're doing this and it's for something bigger than our moment here. And I think like you, when you open your eyes to wrongful convictions, the rate at which they happen, which are all estimates because, you know, it's hard to know, but what we're learning from DNA and what it's uncovering, it's kind of hard to then just be like, oh, like not going to think about that. I think maybe a lot of people do, or maybe that's why they don't even want to know. But again, I see that changing. And I think a lot of shit has happened in our country this year that my hope is that actually it's breaking something wide open that needed to happen. And people are maybe ready to hear horrific stories that they need to hear so they know what's happening, because you can't really help if you don't know, right? And so I'm just thrilled you're doing it, and you're in really good company. David Rudolph and his wife Sonia Pfeiffer are both defense attorneys, and they have a podcast coming out called Abuse of Power, and they are just focusing on wrongful conviction cases.
That's amazing. And that's something that, you know, aside from telling the stories and like presenting evidence of like, hey, this is why this person is wrongfully incarcerated, and then doing a call out for help, because of course that's the end goal. I want to give all of the possible resources that someone can do to help these folks, whether it's they have a clemency petition in, right? The governor, whoever, right. You know, I always do a call out at the end, but also to show how this happens and how the power is abused. That's a great name for a podcast. I'm so excited to hear that. But I do that in each episode. And my editor, Amber Hunt from Accused, who is—
Oh, she's your editor?
Yeah.
Oh my gosh.
She's like the most amazing human ever, who has a background in all of this. You know, this is my first time stepping into really this wrongful conviction world. She really helps me cover how the system can get it so, so wrong.
Yeah. And it's hard to reconcile. And I think, again, one thing I'm learning just doing this show and all the people that I talk to, very little is black and white. And I believe in our justice system. I'm grateful for it. It works better than a lot of people's, but it's not perfect, you know, and we have to really look hard at the things that need change. And I just love learning from my guests, like, what is the best thing I can do now that I know this? And I've learned it's voting for a prosecutor who cares about criminal justice reform. So that's like one place where we actually have a lot of power. And in addition to what you're doing, I think you're also humanizing prisoners and inmates. And I think that's something that we have not seen done, even in fiction storytelling. It's easy to just really get down to like a two-dimensional caricature and assume that we know a lot of the details, so we don't need to be bothered, when just like every one of us, very complex individuals and a messy middle like we all have. So I'm just so excited you're telling these stories.
Well, and that's, you know, my years, over a decade, oh my God, years as a journalist, that's what I've always learned to do, is humanize stories. I mean, that's the key to it. And I really started thinking about prison reform and the fact that even if someone isn't innocent, that everyone is a human.
Yeah.
And how capable humans are of compassion and change. And I learned that through this other podcast that I have coming out and following a man for over 2 years, investigating his life and following his story, how human this, you know, quote, convict is, and how much, gosh, even if someone isn't wrongfully convicted, how much room there is to change and grow, especially for younger people, if people incarcerated at younger ages.
Yeah. Well, again, I probably, to my audience, sound like a broken record, because again, I point to the criminologists that I've had on who, there's this aging out idea. Many criminals will age out of crime. It's just really, it will happen, but we have such an over-sentencing issue that then they're incarcerated without any rehabilitation. So likely their story really changes just by staying in prison.
That's exactly what I was going to say. And then you almost sometimes create problems within people by putting them in this system.
Yeah. Yeah. It's hard, because I know I can sound like criminals don't deserve punishment. I believe in justice, and I believe in paying for when you take a life. I really, really do. But I use this example a lot. And, you know, I think about Adnan Syed, whose guilt or innocence is widely debated. And to me, I'm like, okay, but at this point, he's had 20 years in there. Like, I don't know. Is that enough? If he wasn't a serial killer, I don't know. I just think our sentencing for a young man is very harsh. And I wonder if 20 years is enough. But then I think of the victim's family, and I understand the nuances and complexities, and I don't mean to oversimplify. I just wonder if we aren't over sentencing, and if during that time, you know, how are we preparing an inmate for a life outside? And the answer is, I don't think we are, because we plan to just keep them there.
Well, we absolutely aren't. And that's what I learned from speaking with this man who was sentenced at 18. He was 17 when the murder happened, and he got out at 50 something.
Jeez.
He was supposed to die in prison. He was a juvenile lifer, and then they reformed all the laws. And so he, on a fluke, got out. But, you know, hearing from this person how they treat you inside when they just expect you to die in there, and now he's released without any preparation for life on the outside.
Right.
It's a truly incredible system that we have here. And then, you know, you get into the whole parole. When people are paroled out, how are they, you know, this expectation that's on people to get jobs immediately and, you know, reintegrate immediately. You often pay for your parole officer. If you're paying for your parole officer and then you can't get a job and you can't pay them, you're back in prison. It's just so...
Wait, I didn't know this. Parole officers are...
There's like a due.
Whoa.
And I learned this with this man. Yeah, often. And this was in Pennsylvania. So I don't know state by state. I was only focusing on a man who got out within Philadelphia.
Wow.
He had to pay dues, like, to his parole officer. And he would just tell these stories of people who, you know, couldn't get a job right away, and they got to pay the parole officer. So they, you know, steal something.
Sure.
And then you're an offender again. It's just it's set up for failure, not success.
I know. And it isn't simple. So I don't, you know, pretend that it is. The other thing that I think is interesting that I talked about this with David Rudolph and a lot of past guests, is this idea that we're not so different. I think it's a less popular posture, but saying, you know, I am one bad decision away from maybe being the person on the other side of this story. And I think that takes a lot of courage to say, or I don't know, I don't want to make it sound so courage, but I feel the more I think you listen to people's real stories and hear the questions you're asking them, when you listen to those answers, you realize, wow, I have a certain amount of privilege or comfort or things that have happened to me that have allowed me to make a different choice. But take one, two, or three of those things away on a really bad day, you know, what would have happened? And, mm-hmm. you know, just being that honest, that's what we're talking about. This isn't, mm-hmm. it's not so polarized and different, I think, as we think or like to think.
I think, you know, I again, never, not even true crime, but like in, I never imagined myself to be working on wrongful convictions. Like in my life, it was never something I thought about. Like, of course it happens, but it was never something that, you know, was like my forefront of things that Maggie was just paying attention to, you know, like I never thought I would be here. And the only reason I'm here is because I sat down with formerly incarcerated people and listened to them speak. Mm-hmm. And these are people who are not innocent, and just listened to them speak about their humanity and how humans change, and, you know, their advocacy work now, you know, to youths trying to get them to not do what they did. And I think if we had programs in high school, you know how they, or at least my high school, would bring you to a jail and be, and like scare you straight.
Yeah.
I think instead of scaring us straight, if people listened to incarcerated people and we humanized each other, I think there's a better outcome there.
Oh my gosh.
Because I think instead of like demonizing prisoners and, you know, making them this like horrible, scary thing, they're humans.
Yeah.
And I think we just need to have, understand each other's humanity.
I agree. And I think, you know, there are outliers. I think we could agree. There's some textbooks, serial killers and just depraved psychopaths. And I think those are other. I think who's filling up our prison systems is usually not that. Mm-hmm. And the other thing I wanted to talk about is going back to kind of your media and journalism background. And this goes into true crime content. These things we're talking about are not like wrapped up neatly, and they're kind of nuanced, and they're a little jarring at first. And that goes back to what content is being driven by networks and what people want to watch. I mean, really, true crime, people want to watch a bad guy get caught, you know, and the mystery stuff is for a special population. So there's that disappeared, vanished thing. But the rest is just so, it's kind of just really unpleasant, honestly, to like look at the gaping, like, grossness of what goes on in our country without most of us knowing most of the time. So your podcast, new things are happening where I think we're reaching broader audiences, but I want to go back to your journalism work. I'm trying to get this into a question, which is how, like, in what ways do you think people would care more? Like, what would they need to know to care more about things like immigration or what you saw covering other stories unrelated to true crime? Because again, it goes back to that expansion of true crime. Like, a lot could fit under there. Just, we're talking about real things that are criminal that happen to people. And sometimes it's by a system and sometimes by another individual. But how do you think about that?
Yeah, I mean, that goes back to what we were talking about with just humanizing people. I mean, I think when you say, you know, there's thousands of people at the border trying to get in, and then when you go down there, or someone like myself who has goes down there and reports on these stories from a human perspective, you know, not making these humans numbers or statistics, when you make them into a story, you let them speak for themselves.
Right.
You can provide, you know, images and their voices. I think that's what really helps. I mean, I think we just saw it so much with the immigration crisis that we have right now. I mean, you can hear it, and I was hearing it, and I was working in it. But until I went down there, you know, it is hard to relate. It's hard when you're so inundated with news headlines about all these things. It's hard to remember that these are people and children and families. And when you're down there and you're crossing the border and you're seeing, you know, moms breastfeeding babies in 100-degree heat, just standing there for hours trying to get into the United States. I mean, how can you not feel for that? And if you can't, then I don't know what to tell you. Like,
yeah.
So you're a whole other, maybe you are that small population of people that are the outliers. But I mean, truly, I think hearing stories that are so driven by the narrative that the person you're talking about tells themselves. And I think that's, you know, in journalism, we have the phrase called parachuting in, where, you know, so many journalists will, for example, the El Paso massacre that we had last year, the anniversary actually just passed, and the Walmart I was down there, and you know, the entire national news parachuted in and are just talking about what happened, but they're not from there. So yeah. We were able to tell a story because my editor at the time was from Juarez, mm-hmm. and would cross that bridge every day to go to that Walmart. It was called the quote Mexican Walmart because Mexico and El Paso, Juarez and El Paso are, you know, synonymous cities. So as a kid, her and her dad would just walk over that bridge and go to Walmart, go back to Mexico.
Wow.
And so we were able to tell it in such a different perspective mm-hmm. than CNN, MSNBC, everyone that was coming there. And I think that's what really matters, is telling the stories of the people who are there through them.
Yeah. Yeah. That parachuting in is a good term. And also it implies like a drop in and then a quick,
and then drop,
a yep, quick and exit, out. Right? It's yep. like really probably leaving collateral damage. Really interesting. I think I know the answer to this, but do you consider yourself, because I know you're probably a consumer of true crime. You just told me that you're watching a doc right before we got on, a Netflix doc. Can you be a critic and a consumer of this genre? And if so, like, what does that look like for you?
Oh my gosh, yeah. I mean, I really am like that weird person that the only like things I have to talk about are morbid, true crime related. It truly is depressing. Like when my therapist was like, so what are you doing to keep, you know, happy during the pandemic? I'm like, well, I just, you know, listen to all these like horrible true crime podcasts. And now I'm reading a Anne Rule book about Ted Bundy. And then mm-hmm. later I'm going to watch this new documentary on ID. Like, I'm just like, that's all I do. I don't know. I can't find anything else interesting. Like I used to love sci-fi. And now for me, it's like, the truth is stranger than fiction, honestly.
Exactly. Why would I suspend my disbelief when I can actually believe something that's really happening? Like it's easier in a weird way. I know, I feel the same way. I'm trying to expand the genre, you know,
well,
what I put in.
Especially when like my partner, you know, he'll tolerate it, but it's certainly, you know, I have to contain myself.
Yeah.
Where we're like, I want to just like rant about Ted Bundy over our steak dinner. He's like, can we just not today?
Moratorium like, on that, at least at the dinner table.
Please.
Yeah. No, it's good to have a partner who's not in it as much. I think that's probably very healthy. So tell us the date of Unjust and Unsolved, and like, will it be weekly? Which day? So everybody's prepared.
We launched September 10th, and we did two episodes. So hopefully you heard both of those. One of them has a truly surprising ending. And one of them I've actually become pretty good friends with. He's an amazing person. He's going to do great things if and when he gets out. I always say when, because I just mm-hmm. have this hope. And it's going to be every Thursday.
Every Thursday. Okay, good. So one thing new I'm doing in season two is I'm trying to group episodes into small series. So in September, I'm calling it Justice/Injustice because neither word seemed right. And they're kind of a mix of both. So like I told you, we've got David Rudolph talking about wrongful convictions, you. And then I have a two-parter with an exoneree himself that I'm not going to say the name of because it won't be out. But and yeah, I think people hearing these stories more and that becoming a little more normalized. But it's just, there's nothing like hearing it directly from the source. So thrilled for what you're doing. And one thing that hasn't changed is before my guests go, I always ask them the same question. And that is, what is keeping you up at night? Literal, figurative, both.
Literally my new kitten, my pandemic kitten that I got, whose tail you saw before, she is insane. And she's screaming at me right now, like, Mom, I need to eat.
Oh.
She literally keeps me up. But honestly, like ever since I started looking into wrongful conviction stories, it is haunting. And my inbox is flooded with just the word out already on people wanting me to cover their stories. I'm getting letters from people that are incarcerated who, you know, I might've spoken to their friend on the inside and now they're like, oh, write her.
Oh my gosh.
I mean, it's truly keeping me consumed and awake at all hours of the day.
That's a big responsibility.
Yeah. And so that's what I was saying. I think I want to just, you know, try and share each one of these stories as bonus or whatever, and not in a context of like, this person's innocent, but like they are claiming they're innocent.
Yeah.
What do y'all think that are listening? If you feel compelled to write them, research, be an advocate, here they are.
Yeah. Cause that sounds like a big job for just you. And if one thing the true crime community is good at, it's, you know, crowdsourcing, getting involved, participating. So I think that's a great idea. Well, Maggie, I'm really excited about your podcast and that we finally got to connect in real life. And thank you so much for being on Dialogue.
Thank you, Rebecca. I'm so excited. And we should get a drink sometime. Masks on.
Masks on outside. Let's do it. I'd love it. Okay.
Awesome.
Thanks, Maggie.
All right. Bye. Thank you.
Thanks for killing the small talk. Dialogue is a Yellow Tape Media production edited by Jason Usry and produced and hosted by me, Rebecca Sebastian. Please be sure to subscribe to Dialogue, a true crime conversation, wherever you listen to podcasts, and follow us on social media. We are at Dialogue Pod across all platforms. You can also drop me a note or a guest suggestion or sign up for my newsletter at RebeccaSebastian.com. Be sure to join me every Wednesday for a new episode and another killer conversation.